Hey, you found Here Chicago, homegrown Chicago storytelling. We're a creative community event bringing people together from all over Chicago through food and stories. These stories are told live on the first Sunday of every month to a full Chicago theater. People who take our stage are teachers, programmers, opera singers, farmers, dancers, cab drivers, doctors, graffiti artists, and more. Telling true stories with no pages, no notes. We invite five people to feature who we think you'd like to hear from and offer five open storytelling spots to our audience. We also host a giant potluck dinner, which you have to be here to share. So come visit us next month. It's even better live. Tickets and location can be found at herechicago.org. That's H-E-R-E, chicago.org. Enjoy the show. She also seeks tirelessly to improve upon and alter the landscape of other artists that have disabilities. Her goal is to create more access and awareness for others to express their true selves through art, while also bringing light to the world through comedy. She sits on the board of AllProv, as well as Second City's first ever accessibility advisory board, and they are so lucky to have her. She has traveled and performed in many comedy festivals in the U.S., and she's a producer of the show Who Dis? Variety Show, which benefits mental health, chronic illness, and disability services in Chicago. I also just want you to know I've been to, like, listening to Understand sessions with Liz at different, like, improv retreats and different theatrical workshop settings, and she's one of the smartest people I've ever had the pleasure of hearing facilitate anything, so I'm really excited that she's here. Will you guys please give her a warm welcome to the stage? Liz, come on.
Okay, so as Jana mentioned, I was born with a physical disability. Growing up as a child with a physical disability didn't give me a lot of time or ways to express myself through movement. I had my first surgery when I was 5 months old, and it was 15 hours long. By the time that I was 12, I had had 9 surgeries on my legs. Today, my surgery count is 16, and yes, I threw myself a super sweet 16th surgery party, a la MTV 2001. Because I couldn't express myself physically like a lot of other kids, I wasn't on the playground, I ended up developing a really rich inner world. So I spent a lot of time organizing all of my stuffed animals around my room and then wasting Polaroid film taking pictures of them. Then I think I was about 10 when I got my first hand-me-down Dell box computer and I began writing. And it was in these moments that I created stories about children that were like me, only they were maybe a little bit more abled than I was, maybe less large as me. They were children that had confidence and courage. And those were two things that I did not feel I had as an early adult, child, young adult. And so as I got to know myself, I got to know my mind and my heart, because I spent so much time at this computer and in my room writing alone, avoiding the trauma of my childhood. And what I learned is there's this energy that was living inside of my body. I was in a wheelchair, or I had full leg casts or braces until I was 7. And so my body wanted to do something. It was like instinctively it knew how to run, but it couldn't run. I was literally weighed down. So I, let's see. So I was literally way down, and what I liken it to is mitochondria. I remember learning in like sixth grade, or like the energy cells in our body. And I imagined each of my mitochondria as little tiny volcanoes, and they wanted to explode, and they couldn't. Someone put a stopper on top of them. I equate it to the feeling of holding your breath. If you've ever been asked to take a deep breath in and hold it for as long as you possibly can, there's that moment when you feel like you are literally going to explode before you feel the relief of that release. My body was never able to release that energy. Now, luckily, I grew up with two older brothers, two guys that I really admired and I wanted to be like. I used to sneak into their room to listen to their music and figure out what they were into so I could go to school and pretend like I was cool and like I discovered these artists all on my own. It never worked. And they went through a phase where they were really into wrestling. I'm not a wrestler. I don't like wrestling. I did watch Glow recently on Netflix. It's a great show. But so to hang out with them and have an excuse to hang out with them, I pretended like I liked wrestling. And one day I was in my room and I was just by myself. I was either taking photographs or just kind of hiding out from the world. And I could hear them yelling about wrestling in the next room. And I could hear like the thuds and the banging. And I was like, this is my moment. And it was as if all of my little mitochondria volcanoes erupted. And so I go running down the hallway, but I can't run. So I'm sort of wobbling. And I throw open the door to my brother's room, and I'm standing like this, and I yell, I am Hulk Hogan! And then I tried to rip my shirt off, because that's what Hulk Hogan does. And I never felt more powerful. My brothers are screaming and laughing. They don't know what to do. Their six-year-old little sister, who's disabled, wearing plastic leg braces, is pretending to be Hulk Hogan. And I jump into the pile of them wrestling. And what we didn't realize is that all of that strength came bursting out of me at once. Like the ferocity of all those years of being stuck in this body that couldn't do what I wanted it to do. And I put my brother in a chokehold.
Oh my God.
And I'm literally strangling him. I have no idea. And he's tapping out on the ground, and I'm thinking I'm winning. This is what's supposed to be happening right now. And finally I realized that he couldn't breathe. So I let go, and my brother was furious. He was like, you tried to play with us, and you ruined it. You couldn't play in the way that we were playing. And he was so mad at me that I decided to put Hulk Hogan away for a very long time. I retreated back into my inner world. I ended up realizing that as a kid who was different from other kids, I was going to be made fun of, and I was going to be ridiculed. So I lived my life trying to make myself as small as possible. Because if I was invisible, I couldn't hurt anyone like I hurt him that day, and nobody could hurt me. Until about 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with really early stage cancer, and I ended up taking an improv class. And it was something that I hated from the get-go. I thought, this is miserable. Why would anybody want to do this? This is terrifying. I'm afraid. I'm so nervous. And I had a full-blown panic attack, tears, frozen, every public speaker's worst nightmare. And I got through it. It was totally fine. And then after that, I did a scene, and I realized that the art of improvisation is about looking at somebody, about making a connection, about building art with someone. And my life changed forever. Later that night, we had something that's called a social, where we all could get together and play a game. And there was a game that required running and taking someone's space. And I'm feeling confident. I'm feeling all of those volcanoes of energy like bubbling up inside of me. And someone tags me and I'm like, I don't play these games. I don't run. I don't do this. This is stuff that this disabled kid does not do. And so I decide to run over and take someone's spot. But because I don't know my own strength and I don't move my own body, I knock my instructor to the floor. And I think, oh no, it happened again. I let my Hulk out and I hurt somebody. I ended up helping Brogan up, and she was not mad at me. She had seen me have a panic attack, and she had seen me get through it, and she watched me have a moment where I was so in my life and in my body that she did not care that she fell over, and she was fine. So for me, I found that my Hulk Hogan has a place to live now, and it is on the stage expressing myself. It is getting to be here and let my body move in a way where I can support me and other people can support me through the art of improvisation. I call my inner Hulk Hogan now because I don't really, I'm not into wrestling. I call it my lion side, and now no longer I don't have to hide my lion.
Our next storyteller is Michael. Michael is a child psychiatrist, and he just came back from New Haven, Michigan with his wife, where they were going to wineries and having an amazing time.
It's fun to be here. So my wife and I, sitting right there in front of me now, just celebrated 32 years of marriage. Yeah, easy applause, right? So our wedding, which was a little over 32 years ago, people will say, they talk about it, that it was something that was not unforgettable, memorable. Well, you know the difference between, like, there's famous and infamous? Like, you know, you get known by everybody, but sometimes it's for the wrong reasons. We're going to talk about that right now. So going back to that time, Kim and I had been engaged for, you know, a while, 3-4 years, maybe close to 5 years, as she's telling me. So we thought this out. I was raised Jewish, right? But by then, I was pretty clear I was an atheist, right? And back in 1980s, it wasn't as cool to be an atheist as maybe it is now, right? But Kim was raised in Northern Baptist and attended church and sang in the choir. Although I wouldn't say she was a devout about her religion, she was definitely, you know, someone who went to church and her family did regularly. So when it came time to get married, there was some compromising that needed to be figured out, right? Where are we going to get married? How are we going to do it? Well, interestingly, the pastor who had been at their church not that long, Pastor Michael, my first name, so that was cool already, right? I like that. Turned out he was actually half Jewish in his heritage. So I'm like, all right, maybe this guy can marry us. Maybe it'll go okay. But you got to meet with him beforehand, right? So we met in his office, whatever they call it, in a church. We're kind of having to go through the thing so he can get to know me a little bit. He pretty much knew Kim, so I think I might have used bad language, and they're not swearing, but although he probably did that too, not at that time. But I think I said something like, "Just throw me a bone here." It's like, could you not talk? Could we not have Jesus in the ceremony? Like, I'm okay with generic God. I didn't tell him I was an atheist, of course. But Kim knew it. He was like, "Yeah, that's cool. We'll do it that way. Fine." So we decided, so we weren't going to get married in a church or a synagogue or anything, so we decided we would get married outside, and we were doing it in the side yard of Kim's parents' home. So it was a lovely day in September that day, but as we just recently experienced, it was a little warmer than average, right? It was kind of a fucking hot September day. And I'll tell you what, you know, when you're wearing a black tux, that's one, not necessarily the kind of thing you want to be wearing on a very muggy, warm September day. But Kim had calculated this out. We had like this arch of flowers and that was going to be set up to where we were going to get married, and it was going to be in the back of her yard, and you know, the chairs were all set up in a certain place so that the way the sun came down, it was going to be cool. The sun wasn't going to be on us during the ceremony. Great. Pastor Michael, who I thought was my friend, decided, I don't like this. I'm going to move this thing a little bit forward without our knowledge ahead of time. So anyway, we all get out there, we're up there, and of course the sun is now beaming down on my head, all of our heads, really. But Kim's wearing white, I'm wearing black, right? Yeah. So on the one side, the bridesmaids, they're up here, the groomsmen are here, lined up on the side, it's the usual wedding thing. My mom's behind us, I'm the firstborn, first wedding, so she's all excited. Kim's mom, they've been through something already with their older sister, so they were maybe less excited, but we're not going to talk about that either. Anyway, so we're all up there. And of course, you know, the pastors like to do some spiel about whatever they like to do about love and weddings and all that stuff. But he's going on and on, and I'm looking around. And I look over it this way. My sister is one of the bridesmaids, and she's a little, about a year or two, younger than me. And suddenly I see her, like, she's sitting down. What the hell's going on here? She gets back up at some point. I look over here at one point, and my brother, who's 7 years younger than me, he's one of the groomsmen. So I see him standing there, and they're all wearing their black tuxedos, and all of a sudden I see him go like,
oh, no.
Kind of like this, like catch himself. I thought, oh, there's a bug or a bee on the grass, maybe. But then I see him, I look over there again, and he's looking like pasty, and he's all like, ah, oh, and I think probably at some point he was sitting in a chair. And when I saw that, I mean, I was excited to get married. Believe me, I was. I was no doubts about that. At least not that I'm going to talk about that. Right? Okay. But the sight of him almost like clearly like having a weird passing out thing, as I'm standing there, it sort of just like flipped a switch in me, right? And I started feeling weird things in my body that I never had. And I'm holding Kim's hand right here, and she'll tell you that she sort of felt my hand get like squeezing her hand at some point and getting all kind of sweaty and stuff like that. And I'm feeling kind of weird. And I had never passed out before in my life, nor since have I ever passed out. let that be clear. But suddenly I felt like the lights going down and I was just like buckling, sort of more like a tree falling in the woods, like if an accident had kind of done that. So I did. I was on the ground. And it was like, if there was a baby Jesus up there looking down at me, he would have been like, I fucking told you so. This is happening. And then, you know, I felt like it was a Rocky movie or something. My wife is like thinking, get up. Okay, so my first instinct was, I got a wedding to do. I'm standing right up. That was not a good move. Not a good move. Because I went down again real quick. And Jesus is up there laughing even harder at me. You should have left me in the ceremony. Oh, well. Meanwhile, what am I going to do at this point? You know, the chair is being rushed to me. A friend of mine who's in medical school at the time, she's like tending to me. I don't know what she was doing. Cousin who's a nurse, they're getting orange juice. I'm like, oh, let's go on. I want to get up. And, you know, I'm like, okay, I'll just sit here for a second and, you know, drink some juice, blah, blah, blah. Calm down after, I don't know, a couple minutes or so. But there's like, you know, this pause in the wedding. And then I hear Kim at some point going, we're going to get through this. We're going to get through this. We're going to do this. And that helped. And the rest was history. When we got married, we made it through the day. Of course, this is why people don't forget our wedding. But if I learned anything that day, I mean, sir, when you get married, I mean, it is about love, right? You should love the person. You should like the person. But it's really about having each other's back, right? And that's kind of what I learned today, that, you know, Kim had my back, and it started out that way, and it's been like that ever since.
Featured storyteller coming to the stage is Asghar Sharif. Now, Asghar, you don't have to get up yet. I'm going to talk about you a little bit for a second here. She is our youngest storyteller ever. I found out about Asghar because some of my friends work for WBEZ, and they produce a podcast that she wrote. So she's like their youngest podcaster ever, and there was an email address that you could write to. I listened to it. It was so beautiful. So I wrote with my compliments. And now we're like lucky enough to have her here. I also want to tell you that, let's see, where can you go? So if you want to communicate with Asghar, you can go to Asghar's Wish, which is A-Z-K-A-S, Wish, @gmail.com. If you like her work and you want to pay her compliments, she graciously accepts them. I will also tell you her podcast is called The Stealer of the Diamonds. You can listen to it. You can just Google those words online. You can hear it. She has 2 or 3 episodes in now. And her sister, I just found this out tonight. Is Afifa here? Her sister, Afifa, produces her podcast now. She
basically took over for WBEZ's, like, advanced technicians. And she so that's awesome, too. So please give Asuka a warm welcome today.
Dun, dun, dun.
I call it.
they returned the stolen items. Everyone was happy to get their things back. Tessa admitted what she did was wrong. She told Anna, "You win, I lose."
Oh my gosh. That's page.
No.
Oh, sorry.
Jason and Anna were glad that Tessa said she was wrong and learned her lesson that is how the story ends. A little bit of advice before I go. If your crowns break, don't be upset. Look at the bright side. There's more to share. Until next time, I'm Aska. See you later, folks. Woo!
To be a performer. I do remember setting up shows for the family, the stereotypical ones and all, especially the hula dances. I was big on making up elaborate hula productions. I would set up stuffed animals to watch if my family was too busy. The stuffed animals loved it. I did not have a coconut bra, but I did have like a Tupperware bowls and rope. So that works in a pinch, fun fact. Just a towel works for the bottom part. So I knew that I'd always wanted to be somewhere on a stage, and I didn't know exactly how. I'd seen television, and I just wanted to jump into that square and be a part of whatever I was watching. And it wasn't something I obviously knew that I could do, especially if I wasn't close to LA or New York. I was somewhere in the rest of the country that wasn't those places that seemed impossible to act. And so when my brother would have a chorus concert, I would be ready. I would dress up. If any of you remember, I was born in 1979, and so around that time, one of the cool things for girls, or anyone who chose, would be to buy, in the dollar section, those clip-on earrings made of plastic, and it would come with a plastic necklace. If you wanted to be gorgeous, you would wear those. My mom didn't always want me wearing those to church on Sunday, and I was so mad because there was no way to be any fancier than those. But I do remember putting those on one night for a chorus concert of my brother, who was 2.5 years my senior. Such a cool guy. The outfit picture, if I remember it well, matching peach skirt made of a sweatshirt material, long sleeves, turtleneck. Also peach. Went with my olive skin perfectly, I'm sure, as a 6-year-old or so. And I had heard him practicing the song once, and I was sure that I knew most of the words to some of the songs. I think there was only 5, but in my mind, it was a 2-hour production. It was so exciting. And I was finally got to the car, and we drove there, and we walked in, and it was the school auditorium, bigger than this, art sloping downwards, and on the stage it was so bright, but in the audience you could hardly see each other, right? And I was wondering if they would see me. What if the teacher didn't see me and know that I was ready? So at first I watched the first song and I was like, that's okay. Maybe it's a smaller number. They won't need me yet. And as the second song came on, I thought, my posture is not good enough. So I made sure I was sitting up taller. And I whispered to my mom, she went, shh. I don't think she knew my plan, by the way. I didn't write up a manifesto or an exciting, like, play-by-play. So the third song came, and that was one of the fun ones, where they were clapping, and I was clapping back there, and I was so into it. And my mom told me, shh, a little bit. That was fine. My light went off for a minute, but I turned it back on. I've got a gas lamp inside of me. And so it was time for the fifth song. Never squeeze a weasel. And the words, or this is a poem, you could look it up, and it said, you should never squeeze a weasel by the tail. Don't just please or squeeze a weasel, please or sneeze or something, weasel. Something, something about the weasel. And I was just like in like Les Mis when they've got the torches, and I'm so ready to come down the aisle. And I was waiting, and nobody called me up. Surprisingly. I grew up. Well, I'm working on growing up. So now I teach improv and do it on stages all around. And if I ever find other six-year-olds who want to come up on stage, I will let them. Yeah.
We don't tell people what the theme is or what kind of story to bring. We don't even ask them to tell us what their story is before they bring it. But luckily enough, as you might have noticed so far, themes often emerge. Yeah. So just be aware of that because it's always fun to think about it at the end of the show.
Our next walk-up storyteller is Ittles. Ittles, walk up to the stage. Ittles is from Chicago. And he's a stand-up comedian.
All right. My real name is Nicholas Casillo, and all my friends call me Ittles. No one ever calls me Nick. And I am a known gang member and convicted felon for selling lots of cocaine and heroin. I have been released from prison for about 9 months, and I got introduced to stand-up comedy at my sentencing date. So the judge said, Mr. Casillo, exactly how much time do you think you should serve? And I told him, well, you know, I've already served a significant amount of time waiting to see how this case would turn out. How about no more days? And he said, you, sir, should get into stand-up comedy. Then he gave me 10 years. That was awesome. Anyways, this story goes a little bit back. It's about my little brother and I. And we're super close. My brother's been dating this girl at the time for about 13 years. He's had two kids on her and whatnot. And this day starts out almost like any other day. I wake up at about 7 a.m. My phone's blowing up. Heroin addicts love heroin bright and early in the morning. So my day starts early. But my brother is a part-time junkie, so my brother is calling me bright and early in the morning. Now, the thing about my brother is, he is either trying to get high and wants a discount, because we're family, or, you know, he is in some type of trouble. He either owes a dealer or borrowed some money and can't pay it back, whatever it is. So I'm avoiding his call, but he keeps blowing me up, so I think maybe he's in trouble. I say, hey, Graham, what's going on? And he's like, man, listen, I got drunk last night, and I hooked up with this chick. And I'm like, all right, right on. Sounds like it's a pretty good story so far. And he's like, shut up and listen. So we go to the hotel. He sleeps with her, tries to sneak out in the morning without her getting up. So he avoids all that weird, like, hey, I don't know your name, you don't know my name. But so anyways, the chick sits up, in the bed, like the poltergeist, and says, "Hey, by the way, before you leave, I meant to tell you my parents died from AIDS." So I'm like, "Oh, shit," you know? And he's like, "Yeah, no shit." I said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And he says, "I don't know. I'm fucking calling you. What do I do?" And I say, "Look, man, you got to go down to the clinic right now. Go get tested. And then in 6 months, you know, you gotta go get tested again. See whether or not you're going to get AIDS." And so he says, "What? You think I'm going to go get tested?" I said, "Man, you got to go get tested." He said, "Fuck that, man." I said, "Well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with your life?" He says, "Listen, I'm going home right now. I'm going to go sleep with Jane unprotected and see how that turns out." I said, "Why the fuck would you do that? What the fuck are you doing?" He says, "You think I want to die alone?" And that's the end of that story. That's it. That's all I got. Wow. I don't know if you want to clap for that. No.
Oh. Did he go sleep with Jane?
Oh, yeah.
Aww. Iddles.
Yeah, I got a lot of those.
All right, thank you. Give him a round of applause. All right. Our next storyteller is Perfecto Diaz. That is his real name. Not a stage name. So Perfecto works at a mortgage company where people come to realize their American dream. But he has always wanted to be on stage to share his stories. This is kind of a first time in person. This is one of those situations where I've seen Perfecto tell stories not on a big stage like this, and I'm tempted to like really hype him up, but what I found is that you shouldn't do that before somebody comes onto a stage. You shouldn't. You should. All right. He's like, "Yeah, don't do it." But he's great. Perfecto is originally from Chicago, and he grew up in Wicker Park. He is mostly a writer. He recently took a live storytelling class for the first time, and he hopes to continue this new art form for many years to come. Please give him a warm welcome to the stage.
So, in the fall of 1998, there was this little kid by the name of Jordan who was always running around and full of energy and life. I knew Jordan through my cousin who was 7 years old, and they were both 7, and I was 12. So I was in charge of these two knuckleheads while my aunt was taking care of a 2-year-old at home. Now, I love my cousin. I think legally I have to say I love him. But Jordan was the cool one. Jordan was the one who wanted to play home run derby in the backyard, and we pretended like we were Sammy Sosa and Mark McGuire. We don't anymore, but we would ride our bikes around over and over again, and we would play that board game Jumanji, based on the movie Jumanji, mm-hmm. and we would roll the dice and see if one of us could get sucked into the game, like the movie Jumanji. It was a lot of fun until one day my aunt came up to me and my cousin and was like, "Listen, boys, I have something to tell you. You're not going to be seeing that much of Jordan." Now, we were kind of just like, "Well, we just saw him just a little bit ago. Like, what do you mean we're not going to see him? Unless he got sucked into Jumanji." Did he get sucked into the Jumanji board yet? And my aunt was just like, "What? No. What are you talking about?" "No. Guys, this is pretty serious, and I don't know the best way to say this, but we found out today that Jordan was diagnosed with cancer." Now, I didn't know that much about cancer. I was 12 years old. It was 1998, before like Google was a main thing. So all I knew was that adults get diagnosed with cancer, they lose their hair, and then later on they die. But this is a weird situation because we're talking about like a 7-year-old kid here. So my aunt leaves the room, and my cousin's pulling on my shirt, and he's like, "Well, do you think Jordan's gonna like die or something?" And I was like, "Well, no, he's a kid. Like, it can't happen." happen, but honestly, I had no idea. So a year went by without seeing Jordan. And we're at this Scarecrow Fest in St. Charles, Illinois. And it's pretty cool, like there's scarecrows, spoiler alert. There's rides, there's games, and it's fun for the whole family to go to. So it was a great time, but it got better because my aunt came up to us and was like, "Great news, guys. Guess who's here? Jordan's here." And we're all pumped up because we get to see our friend finally. Like, oh yeah, Jordan's here. It's going to be great. All of a sudden, my aunt comes up with Jordan. Now, Jordan looks a little bit different. He has no hair. He has glasses now because his eyes are really blurry. It's a hearing aid because he can't really hear. He's even a little bit chubbier than before. But, like, we didn't care. We just wanted to see our best friend. So we're like, "Jordan, nice to see you, man. Hey, there's this ride where, like, a swing just go around and around and around. God knows what reason. But it's really fun. You want to go?" And you could tell, like, the energy was not there, but the smile did say, like, "Yes, let's go." So we go on the ride, and of course we go around and around and around, and we get off the ride, and we're talking about how it reminded us of the scene from Star Wars, Phantom Menace, where the race, they go around and around and around. And then we start talking about our favorite song in the world. "The Saga Begins" by Weird Al Yankovic. Now, if you never heard this song, it's pretty much a parody of American Pie, but with Star Wars lyrics. It's pretty amazing. So we started singing it, but then Jordan came up to me and was like, "Well, I wish I knew the whole words of the song." And I was like, "Well, Jordan, don't worry about it. I'll teach you the song, you know?" And he's like, "Really?" And I'm like, "Yeah, Jordan, like, I'll teach you. I promise, I'll teach you those words." Now, later on that night, I went to my grandparents' house, and I started to write the song down on a piece of paper, because like I said, this is 1999, and before, like, internet was, like, all over the place. So you had to do stuff from scratch. So took the pen, took the paper, started writing it down. But this was a 6-minute song. And my handwriting was terrible. So even if Jordan did have perfect vision, he was not going to read this. So I started thinking, what if I record myself singing the song slowly and loudly for him on my grandpa's little recording machine in the front room? So I go to the front room, I get the little microphone that's attached to the machine, I put the little tape in the little cassette thing, and I press the red button, and I start recording myself. Now, like I said, I have to be slow and loud, so I was kind of just like, my, this here Anakin guy, maybe Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. Like, I didn't write the lyrics, okay? You're looking at me like that. But it took me the whole night because I only had this machine that can only do so much. And so every time I made a mistake, it would be like, press the rewind button, like, and then press the recording again the whole night and morning. So I was finally done with the song. Huh. I felt really good about myself. Like, yeah, I kept my promise, you know. I think Jordan's going to love it. I personally love it. It's going to be great. All of a sudden, from a distance, I hear, "Oh, no." And I'm kind of just like, "What's, are you talking about my singing? Like, what's going on?" And my grandma comes in to the room, and she comes up to me, and she says, "Listen, mijo, your aunt just called. Jordan passed away this morning." And I just stood there, like, in silence. And my grandma comes up, she says, "Look, yesterday when you boys were on that swing ride, I could see Jordan's face glowing. And I could see him looking out in the sky as if he was, like, seeing heaven for the first time." And I just stood there, and I was just like, "Don't tell me that. A little kid just..." So I took the tape out of the machine, and I took the film out, and I went up to the garbage can, and I just threw it in there, and that was it with that song. Because, you know, like, I made a promise, and I felt like I failed. 15 years later, I'm at work. I'm working, and I'm listening to some random 90s playlist that someone put up, and it's on some shuffle, and all of a sudden, The Saga Begins by Weird Al Yankovic starts playing. The minute I hear the first few words long, long time ago, I just start crying at my desk. And I put on Facebook that I can't believe that I'm crying because of a Weird Al Yankovic song. Later that night, I'm at this Mexican restaurant up north, and it's like packed with people all around, and I'm sitting with my friend, and my friend's asking me, "Hey, what's up with that Weird Al Yankovic song and you crying?" And I said, "Well, I was crying because tomorrow is Scarecrow Fest." And 15 years ago, around this time, a friend of mine passed away, and I promised him I was going to sing him or teach him this Weird Al Yankovic song. I didn't say which one. I just said, I promised I was going to teach him this Weird Al Yankovic song, but I never got the chance to. Out of this crowded place, a little boy, had to be 6 or 7 years old, goes through the crowd of people, looks at me, looks dead in the eyes, and starts singing. My, this here Anakin guy, baby Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And the dad comes out of the crowd, just like, what are you doing? Why are you bugging these two people? I'm so sorry about that. And they vanish. And my friend looks at me and is like, that kid just pointed you out of everyone here to sing you a song. And I said, not just any song, but The Saga Begins by Weird Al Yankovic. Now, next month marks the 20 years since Jordan passed away. 5 years since that incident happened in the restaurant. And I often wonder what to make of it, honestly. I still have no clue. Because in my head, the saga ended when Jordan passed away. I was done with the song. I was done with the movie The Phantom Menace. Okay, well, I was done with that movie because that movie just sucked. But I was done with anything that reminded me of the promise that I failed to keep. But I like to think that somewhere out there, there's a little boy running around, probably playing Jumanji with the real Robin Williams, trying to send me a message saying that he now knows the song, The Saga Begins, by Weird Al Yankovic.
I was approached to tell a story, I said, why not? So I'm going to tell you a story of something that happened in 1985. a friend of mine, we're both artists, and we decided we need to make money. It's ridiculous that we just dabble and do all these unusual things, but we want to make money. So we started a business, and it was called Keytab, which is boutique backwards. So someone gave us, a good friend gave us, yard goods of material, and it was free. So that was the first thing. He owned a fabric store, and they were seconds, but it had to be a solid color. So we got yard goods of white and beige and pink, all light. And we decided that it would be a good idea to have somebody sew the fabric that we designed. We started out with silk chiffon scarves, and they were 60 inches by 12, which are, you can imagine, quite long. And we took the scarves into a boutique store on Oak Street, and this woman, she fell in love with them. They were, if you don't know the process, batik, it's a wax resist, and there's a lot to it. So it started off, we were just so energetic because she was very well known, and she wanted 24 of them. And she said, we said, well, how much, you know, she says, well, you know, I double the cost. So she says, $22, I could sell them for 44. Whew, and we're like thinking all of this. And we got very excited. And we started to rent different studios all over the city because you can't do it outside in the winter, and it's very, very messy. You have to paint, and then you have to iron the wax off. It's very time-consuming. So it turned out we got this big order, and then we got another big order and another big order, and oh, we were so excited, except we couldn't do the orders. We didn't have enough manpower, just the two of us. So we ended up hiring a rep that they would go around and get the orders, and that's how it grew. So one time, this was towards the end of the, well, let me just backtrack. So the business grew, but we had to hire people to do it. It would never work with just the two of us. So we ended up hiring cousins, sister, and a sister-in-law, and a friend. And of course, we had to pay them. So our profit went down very, very quickly. So for example, the skirts that we had made, they were one size fits all, which they were wrap skirts, so we didn't have to do sizes. And then we had the scarves, and we had t-shirts. It was a really nice line. Okay, maybe 8 years later, down the road, we must have moved at least six times, because when you batik, when you do the process, you have to dip the clothing in a vat, and then it has to dry, and you hang it on a line. Well, all the moisture from the line, from the clothes hanging, I mean, if you can imagine, from here to there, there must have been about maybe 20 t-shirts hanging with matching scarves. Anyway, we were evicted several times. It just, you know, and then we went and found another studio and another studio. There is a point to this story. So after really making no money, we said, who cares? It's fun. We're getting well known. We even signed our name. Okay. Maybe it was 8 years later, and my partner was getting so sick of it. I mean, she was not as enthusiastic or as excited as I was. But she said, let's just give it one more chance. I said, okay. So we sold to the store. I'm not going to mention it because it's still there. And the store was on Oak Street, another store. And she loved them. But she gave us an order to, she wanted eight outfits. A skirt, a wrap skirt, a tube top, and a shawl. But the colors that she asked for were green and blue. They were not sophisticated colors. Green and blue and orange and red and yellow and purple. I mean, they were like, what? But we had fun doing it because no one ever wanted those colors. And it was summertime, and at that point we did it outside. And we're doing it outside, so forth. And then we realized there was one outfit we forgot to boil. You also have to boil it to set the color. So, one outfit, which one? We had no idea. And then my partner says, forget it. Let's just send the order out. So, we sent the order to the store, and this this woman calls us, the owner of the store, and she said, "Oh, I'm so excited. I just sold 3 of your outfits. And now I'm not excited because this couple came back and this man, this store sold to hookers. And that's why they wanted these outrageous colors. But the one that we didn't boil was one that she sold." And they walked back into the store, and he's dragging this woman, you know, like this. And he says, "Do you know what happened? My girlfriend got beat up, and I know it." And she says, "I didn't get beat up. I didn't." And he says, "She's all black and blue." And I said, I was on the phone, so I couldn't, you know, really do too much. And she was black and blue. And I said, "Oh." She says, "I am returning every single outfit. And you're not getting paid for them. And that's it." Well, the one that she got caught in the rain. And he thought that somebody had beat her up. And because, you know, she was obviously a beautiful woman. And she was all black and blue.
Oh.
So the story was, don't ever think you're going to make money. Because we had these 6 outfits with obnoxious colors. And we got them all back. And I had a garage sale and just about gave them away. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, you guys. We have our last featured storyteller coming to stage right now. This is Lee Zhang. Lee is a management consultant by profession. She is taking a break in order to fully experience life outside of that profession, and follow her heart. Her professional experience was focused on large-scale transformations in Fortune 500 companies, such as mergers, turnarounds, and changes in global footprint. She has served as the managing director at PricewaterhouseCoopers, as a principal in results delivery at Bain & Company, and as manager at Deloitte. She has a PhD in learning and organizational change for Northwestern University. In her free time, she loves to travel and read and cook and paint and sail and spend time with wonderful people. And also, she is wonderful in UNC. Please give her a warm welcome to the stage.
Jenna knows that I have major stage fright, which is why I'm hanging on to this. It was a hot summer day in Beijing. A 10-year-old girl was running around the tracks of a school field together with her classmates. The teacher said, "There is no limit to this exercise, but you can stop at any time." She was tired and thirsty. She could taste blood from her lips cracking under the heat of the sun, but she kept going. 20 years later, it was 3 a.m. in New York. This girl is now 30 years old, pulling another all-nighter to help make her client successful. Her eyes were red and dry, but she kind of felt like it was nothing compared with her colleague, who persevered through an all-day workshop despite severe pain of what turned out to be appendicitis. So that girl was me, as well as the majority of people I knew for the most part of my life. You know that type, the people who make things happen by striving. The kind of people who are always ready to give their all to some mission bigger than themselves. If working hard is not enough, they work harder. But throughout my life, I've always been intrigued by a different type of people who make things happen by finding sparks in people's hearts and nurturing them into passions. Those passions, in turn, unleash amazing potential. When I was 13 years old, we had a new chemistry teacher, Mr. Zheng. Mr. Zheng was like a lean version of the Buddha, always smiling. would never notice me. Because you see, every time there was a chemistry exam, I would get almost half of the questions wrong. And at the time, I was stretched way beyond my limit in this gifted children's program that would have us skip 4 grades before college. And I was studying so hard that I would fall asleep while standing up reading out loud. But my best was still not good enough, especially with chemistry. And I was humbled and ashamed, but I just kept pushing myself to keep going, even if it's absolutely hopeless. So the arrival of Mr. Jung brought sunshine to my world. The first time we had an exam with him, the paper came back with only check marks for what I did right and no markings for everything I did wrong. And I've never seen anything like it. He told me with smiling eyes to not work harder, but to do less. He said, you know, just go through the textbook and bring me one question a day that you find interesting, and we'll talk through them together. He was so wise that he could see how the root cause of my struggles wasn't in lack of effort, but in doing too much extra practices when I couldn't manage to remember all the fundamentals. So when I first started to bring him one question a day, my face used to burn so much with embarrassment. But he would explain them with complete kindness and encouragement, day after day. I never knew that chemistry could actually be fun. So in a few weeks, I was actually eager to find interesting questions to bring to him. And my heart was filled with wonder and hope and this newly found confidence that I can actually do this. In a few months, I went from absolutely hopeless in chemistry to one of the top students in my class, thanks to how Mr. Jung nurtured my heart. Throughout my life, I met a number of other people who have this kind of special magic. Some of them listened at a deeper level than I could listen to myself and provided unwavering support. Some of them taught me the power of seeing the world as being filled with treasures if you follow the part of your heart that's filled with wonder. Some of them nurtured my interests by sending countless books and letters when I really felt I had no particular talent in that area despite all the little whispers in my heart. In every single case, they taught me the magical things that could happen when there is persistent attention on one's heart. And most of the biggest changes in my life, the most profound changes in my life, happened because of some little spark being nurtured by one of these very special people. And having seen how they make the world a better place, there is such a deep longing in me to be like them one day. So last year, I finally started to take a sabbatical to do things that my heart truly longed for. And besides sleeping a lot, all the fun travels and parties, I started reading extensively about how to do more of what these special people do, maybe in my own line of work. So as Jenna mentioned, I do work in transformations and corporations. These are oftentimes turning points filled with extreme uncertainties and opportunities. We go through periods of time when tens of thousands of people experience both hope and fear, creativity and anxiety, mutual support and loss and sadness. In the past, I used to take care of people by minimizing the negative impacts and unpleasant emotions, but there's so much more that could be done to nurture the positive emotions. The courage and resilience, compassion, the desire to create and grow, deep care and friendship. All of those are sparks in everyone's heart that can be nurtured. across all levels of the organization. So on countless days, I find myself writing out my dreams, exactly how I'm going to do it, the future I love to help create, then meeting me challenge myself a dozen different times. I read up on all the latest scientific findings and case studies in a bunch of related fields. Before I knew it, I've gone through almost 100 books and had countless conversations with people who share my passions and people who have those little sparks in their hearts. One day on my deathbed, I will be very happy if I know that I have been able to contribute to this world in a way that Mr. Jones changed my life. Thank you so much for the work that you do and the work that you just put up here. Gorgeous. Our final storyteller is Anthony. Anthony works at the shed. When he gets stressed out, he goes and visits the penguins. And at night, he goes home to his dog, Rocky, and sometimes does jujitsu. That's all. Anthony, to the stage.
Hi.
Hi.
So I've never done anything like this before.
Woohoo!
Quick show of hands. Who has been made really, really sad and confused by a breakup? So a fairly universal experience, right? So a decade ago or so, I went through my first really bad breakup. And I won't get into like the nitty-gritty details. You know, truthfully, they're kind of immaterial to the story at hand. Suffice it to say that it was appropriately soap opera-like and scandalous, and there was betrayals. But what made it kind of unique is that it wasn't just her that sort of the separation took place from. There were friends of mine. So like the breakup happened, and then there was just this line drawn. And you know, some of these friends that I've known since fifth grade, half my life at that point, you know, came over to my side, and then others went to her side. And it was just this very, very hard, confusing time. And I was losing so many people that I had cared about and built my life around, and my support system really. And you know, it's like a really intangible loss. So it's hard to pin down and really figure out what's going on. It's this awful existential crisis, this heavy despair to put on someone in their mid-20s. At that point, or early 20s rather, at that point I hadn't really experienced loss except for when my grandmother died when I was 15. And the background on that is my mom was a single working mother, and so I spent a lot of time being raised by my grandmother. So she was kind of my rock, and so flash forward, you know, years later, and I'm going through something, and I'm again losing the people that I depend on. So yeah, it was really rough, and I found myself in this tough spot, and a friend of mine's father had recently passed, so they were also going through kind of a different sort of loss. And so her and I kind of, you know, hung out, and we sort of related to each other in both our despair. And it's funny that I work at Shed now, because this story kind of starts to center around museums. So her and I decided that we weren't going to sit around sulking and feeling sorry for ourselves all the time. So we were going to, you know, make the most of our lives. And so we took a trip down to Art Institute. But just prior to that, I had gone to my grandmother's grave. And, you know, I sat there and I talked to her. She died a week before my birthday. And so it's always made my birthday kind of hard, and my birthday was coming up. And so I just, you know, kind of talked to her and you know, just threw this ask out there to her and the universe. Just, I'm really lost. I'm really confused. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. You know, if you could just help push me in the right direction. So my friend Esther and I go to Art Institute, and we're checking out, you know, all these great exhibits and everything. And they had this thing on Hindu art. And then there was this one statue there, and it riveted me. Like, I was completely captivated by it. I had no idea why, but I was drawn to it. And so I went to go check it out, and, you know, reading the little place card, and it said Shiva. And I didn't know anything about Shiva, and I know what you're thinking. You know, I'm going there, brown guy, don't know what it is, but I'm not that kind of brown. Don't judge me too harshly. So, you know, I looked it up, and you know, got probably like some kind of generic Wikipedia explanation that, you know, Shiva is this, you know, god who stands, creates, and destroys the universe. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. I don't know why I like it. I just like it, whatever. Flash forward to another week or so later, Esther and I decide to go visit Adler Planetarium. And so we go to Adler Planetarium, and they have movies that they show, like documentaries. And so we're watching one that's called, it's on Spiral Universes. And truthfully, probably want to go check it out because I might have been a little high. I just like the way they looked. So we go check out this movie, and it starts talking about spiral galaxies. And there are these really pretty things that exist out there in the universe. But every now and then, these spiral galaxies will kind of enter each other's orbit. And then they find themselves, you know, being drawn to one another. And then they sort of, you know, do a dance. So they dance around each other. And they, in that dance, they're exchanging gases and little bits of meteorites, and, or meteors rather, and just these particles and things. And then so sometimes during the course of this dance, the gravity just pulls so closely together that the universes end up destroying themselves, or sometimes birthing a new universe. But oftentimes these universes will do their dance, and then they'll just go their separate ways and move on to the ever-expanding cosmos. So I saw that, and I was like, cosmic dance, that sounds awfully familiar. Mm-hmm. And so I immediately connect, probably because I was high, immediately connected it to the Shiva statue. And then I also immediately had a revelation, like, holy shit, that's not universes, but those are people. Mm-hmm. Those are people that enter each other's orbit. And then for, you know, very brief periods of time, sort of dance around each other, and they exchange gases and meteors and you know, maybe that's bodily fluids, maybe it's just conversations and ideas, but people do this thing. And then sometimes it's so powerful that they destroy one another. And sometimes it's so beautiful that they can give birth to something brand new and amazing. But a lot of times people just kind of come into your life and you have this exchange and then you go your separate ways and that's okay. And that really just smoothed everything out for me, you know? And I was okay with the fact that people I had, you know, grown up with and had my whole life with at that point were no longer there. Because we had the exchanges we had the growth that we had, and that message has served me to this day, you know, 10 years later. Anytime I become friends with somebody, we're into a relationship with somebody, it's always like, oh, well, what if the worst happens? But it's like, that's okay, because we're just going to take this time, and we're going to exchange some things, and, you know, we're both going to grow from it. That's all I got.
Wow.
That's our show this month. Join us again next month for more Stories Told Live. A rotating cast of volunteers makes Here's Chicago go. You can see their names, along with all of the names of our storytellers and co-hosts, at hereschicago.org. If you're in Chicago and would like to take part, the best thing to do is come down and meet us. Visit the website to find location and to view photographs, potluck recipes, and show history. Mary Kate Walthall is our house manager. Molly Emmons is our box office manager. Matthew Williamson is our photographer and sound producer. Here's Chicago is hosted and produced by me, Janice Obell. Thanks for listening. That's our show this month. Join us again next month for more Stories Told Live. A rotating cast of volunteers makes Here's Chicago go. You can see their names, along with all of the names of our storytellers and co-hosts, at hereschicago.org. If you're in Chicago and would like to take part, the best thing to do is come down and meet us. Visit the website to find location and to view photographs, potluck recipes, and show history. Mary Kate Walthall is our house manager. Molly Emmons is our box office manager. Matthew Williamson is our photographer and sound producer. Here's Chicago is hosted and produced by me, Janice Obell. Thanks for listening.